Brother John.
Hey, morning.
Yeah, such as it is. How's the weather there, by the way?
Oh, pretty good. It was, it's probably about 40 right now. I haven't, you know, stuck my nose outside yet, but it's going to be a pretty good day with the weather heating up here in Chicago, getting up into the mid-60s tomorrow, so
Nice.
Have something to look forward to.
Yeah, we're about 50. We're about 50. It's a little cool this morning. Not bad. The sky's clearing up, which is nice. And yep. we're ready to go here. All right.
Hey.
Yeah. What's first on our agenda? Let's talk about baseball.
A little baseball. We've got the World Baseball Classic finally coming to an end last night. It was going to be Puerto Rico playing the U.S. and Puerto Rico had just beaten the U.S. Earlier in the previous pool. So I guess it was a little time for a little revenge, and the U.S. Gave it to them in a big way by winning 8-0.
8-0?
Yeah, the games have been so close up to this point. I mean, when you take a look at the U.S. games, they just barely beat Japan on the semis. And and Puerto Rico had a tough road with Netherlands going to extras before Puerto Rico was able to pull it out. But it just got to the point, it was amazing, because the pitcher that beat the U.S. started for Puerto Rico, and the pitcher that Puerto Rico beat for the U.S. started for them. So it was like the setting was there, comparable, but what you find out with baseball and any kind of sport is that you can only beat a team so many times. You can only go undefeated so long. Mm-hmm. And so when you take a look at the overall record with all the pools, you find that here we have Puerto Rico 7-1, and St. Louis 6-1, and the U.S. 7-1, and Puerto Rico loses because it isn't necessarily what your record is, it's when you win. And they won the game that counted, the U.S. did. And so for the first time in four tries, they have finally succeeded in winning the tournament. And the other thing is the most valuable player happened to be the pitcher who was very dominating last night, Marcus Stroman from the Baltimore Orioles, a pitcher I didn't have a chance to see. He's with the Toronto Blue Jays, but I didn't have a chance to see him, even though I saw the Jays down in spring training.
Gotcha.
And he was the pitcher that the Puerto Rico got six straight hits off of in the semi game. So, I mean, I guess it's what you've done for us lately that counts.
What do you think? You think the U.S. pride kicked in finally at the last minute? They said enough is enough?
Yeah, well, I think that, number one, they had a really good manager who was able to bring the team together. They didn't overdo the pride thing. I think another thing that happened is that they played a little more to win rather than making sure all the players got in. The National League batting champion, Daniel Murphy, who was a super great hitter, he didn't play at all. Instead, they played the second baseman from the American League, who was extremely good, who was hot. Ooh. He was doing well. He had a great batting average. Well, so why take a chance and put somebody in, and we'll let that guy just, you know, linger on the bench and gather splinters from and rather than play. And I think they played to win, and they had a little more emotion than they usually do. Puerto Rico's emotion. Basically, you know, they had been playing on an emotional high throughout the whole thing.
Right.
You know, Yadier Molina is 34 years old. He's the captain. He's the go-to guy. He's the catcher. To show you the solidarity that Puerto Rico had, every one of their players on their team ended up bleaching the top of their hair blonde.
What?
Yes. So if you took a look at, they look so funny. So they look like practically carrot tops that were yellow. You know, it was hilarious.
Why did they do it?
Well, they did it as a form of solidarity to demonstrate.
Oh, I see. They're all doing it. I see.
They all did it. Every one of them.
Oh, wow.
And I was hoping that if the game could have just been a little bit closer, I was hoping that Yadier Molina might become the MVP, you know, rather than Stroman, even though they're on the losing team, just because of how well he did pulling him through this whole exercise, but it just didn't work out. Yeah. Just a couple other quick notes on this. And number one is that I think Molina's emotion just finally cracked on him during the game. You know, it just got to be way too much. And you could see that the letdown of loss. And I'll tell you one thing. And one thing they do with the World Baseball Classic that is really good is that after the game is over with, they both teams line up and congratulate each other.
Good.
And Puerto Rico did that with a lot of spirit.
Oh, nice.
So I thought that was a good part. The other thing is, just to bring Israeli back into it a little bit, their top pitcher who was not on a major league roster and not even had signed up with a major league team.
Ooh.
A guy by the name of Zach Seid is his name. It's a Z-E-I-D, but it's pronounced Zied. And he ended up signing with the St. Louis Cardinals for a minor league contract. So he's going to be playing in their minor league system and having an opportunity to make it into the majors after not playing in the majors since 2014. So,
ooh,
you know, this tournament can be used as a means by which players can be noticed by the major leagues and thereby get another, maybe a last opportunity to make the big leagues.
I wonder why he took the time off.
What's that?
Why did he take the time off?
Take what time off?
Three years. Last time he played in the majors was 2000.
He was playing in the minor leagues.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe
he was trying. He was trying. Nothing military duty.
Okay.
He's your typical. And by the way, they did have, as part of the kind of bringing this whole Israel team together, they did actually have a trip where many of these ball players signed up and volunteered to go over to Israel to kind of bond and learn a little bit more about Israel.
Good.
About a year before this all happened, or maybe even less than a year.
Wow.
So it was, you know, there's a lot of stories, some of them we've talked about already, but mm-hmm. I think now we're ready to move on and get back into spring training, and the season will be starting in like about 2 weeks. So on with Major League Baseball.
Well, I find this whole thing that we just went through with the WBC interesting. I like their format, what they're doing. Some of the things are a little different. It's like we said before, it's a little bit more like the soccer, organizationally speaking, and the pools and all that stuff. I just wonder how much of what goes on in this classic might bleed over to National and American League Baseball. Major League.
No, I think I think that we're, you know, it's, I think there will be a little bit of an effect upon the fans themselves.
Uh-huh.
The effect that's happened immediately is, to give you an example, Netherlands lost their second baseman because of a shoulder injury, and so now the Yankees are scrambling, and the guy's playing out of position. He's a shortstop.
Oh.
So the Yankees are now scrambling to try to find a guy to play for the next 6 weeks. And so, I mean, those are some of the, when the U.S. kind of looks, still, I think there's a lingering negative feeling about the tournament, because we right now have a obvious, you know, here we got a Yankee team who, by the way, has the best record in spring training, which is a meaningless record, but, you know, a win's a win. And, you know, if you're playing well, it's good. So that they're let's just say their stock has risen in their division as a result of, you know, playing well, and all of a sudden now they're you know, encountering a little a little handicap, a little challenge that they have to overcome. So I think those kind of things are what's going to come out of it. Somebody said to me, I was listening to the news guys, and I think the bottom line is the U.S. still feels it's an exhibition. It's an exhibition, and I think the rest of the world feels it's a sign of, you know, what team, you know, of demonstrating that we can play with the best of them.
So
I think that's
two very differing points of view, and that might account for I wouldn't say that the U.S. team was lackluster, but like you said, they were before trying to get everybody to play. They weren't really hardcore playing the win, and that changed.
You know, what's kind of funny, Joe Maddon, the manager of the Chicago Cubs, offered, you know, as a just throwing his two cents into it and brainstorming, he says, hey, look, once the World Baseball Classic's over with, why don't we have another contest with last year's World Series winner against the World Baseball Classic winner?
Good. That's a great idea, don't you think?
It's a good idea. I don't know how they'll squeeze it in there, but it would be an interesting exercise, no doubt. So
I think it'd be great.
Are
we going to see any of these blonde guys, by the way, in Major League
Baseball? Oh, yeah. Puerto Rico is loaded with Major League players.
Oh, cool.
We've got, you know, Yadier Molina. And keep in mind, they were smart enough not to to bleach all their hair. So as a result, it'll fade pretty quickly, and they could probably cut off a major portion of it before they, you know.
Well, I hope they don't. They wear caps anyway most of the time, right?
But, you know, in the interviews, this and that, it was hilarious looking at these guys. And the Cubs have Javi Baez. Cardinals have Yadier Molina. Yankees, you know, like, there's a bunch of them out there. So it'll be fun to see. Maybe you'll have a chance just if you see something major league, you'll capture one of them. There's probably 15 of them out there.
Well, send me some clips if you see any of that.
Oh yeah, I can give you clips of them with a couple of them together and being interviewed.
Beautiful.
It's really neat.
Well, yeah, especially going forward if they keep them. I hope they do. Oh. That would add a little pizzazz to
the
sport.
Well, I'll tell you, that's one thing that they say about this. You know, baseball needs a little shot in the arm for some excitement. Some of the things that these other countries do, and we've talked about,
yeah,
to demonstrate emotion is not allowed because it's not the big league way of doing things.
Right.
When you hit a home run, put your head down, run around the bases, get congratulated by your teammates, but God forbid if you flip your bat too far, or you wave your hands up in the air, or you, you know, wave your cap. After hitting a home run, you've basically shown up the pitcher, and that's not good.
I think the coping mechanism in Major League Baseball, at least early on, was chewing tobacco. They'd keep their nerves, keep their demeanor. They just chew. They take out all their frustration or excitement or whatever on that.
But
wad.
That chew is also a stimulant too.
Yes, sir.
It's like a cigarette.
Well, it's both. It's a vaso.
Yeah.
Whatever.
It's a calming effect too. I mean, it goes, yeah. Which maybe kind of grinds, but you know, now you're not allowed to do that. That's against the rules.
Oh, they can't chew anymore.
They can't chew anymore.
Because of spitting, I guess.
No, it's a health. That's a healthy situation because there's a lot of mouth cancer going.
Oh yeah.
There's a lot of ball players that have suffered cancer as a result of chewing.
Yeah, it's a bad thing. Yeah. Remember when we grew up, everyone chewed.
Oh yeah.
That was a big deal. Remember, we'd go down to, I think when we worked for Pop, we'd go down to Pestalozzi Street or whatever it was, where the
the brewery, yes. Smell the hops and watch people chew, huh?
Well, the other thing, it wasn't watch people chew. You could smell the chew being made. They had all the places that made the chew right around there because they used some of the same stuff.
Hey, you know, there were baseball cards put into chewing tobacco back in the early 50s.
Well, it was a thing, that's for sure.
Yeah, so it was pretty popular.
Cool. Okay. Well, let's move on to our movie stuff.
Oh, movie. Okay. Well, listen. I'll try to be pretty quick about this. But what happened as soon as I got back from my Sarasota trip, in which I decided to have a little culture rather than just going to baseball, so I went to a play called The Little Foxes. It's a Lillian Hillman play that. Was hit Broadway in the late 30s, ran for almost a year, and then was made into a movie starring Bette Davis. And Little Foxes has a setting of about 1900 in a small Alabama town, and it centers around a family of two brothers and a sister who are rich but want to become wealthy.
Right.
And they demonstrate an enormous amount of greed as they try to make their way to that. And as a result, you find more internal strife and disagreement within these three parties, which really creates the energy around the play. So I went to see the play, and in the worst of these three bad, greedy people happens to be the Bette Davis role, the woman who, you know, the sister of these three. So when I came back home, I was eagerly waiting to see that movie. And found out accidentally the day before. I accidentally turned it on about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and sure enough, I didn't miss more than maybe 2 minutes of it.
Huh.
And so I got to see the movie, and then I realized that the movie is featured in Turner Classic Movies as a series of movies. They're having what they call the March Menace Class Festival. So over like between March, May 20th and the 25th, they're having all their movies are going to be basically highlighting very bad people.
And of course, bad Betty behavior. Davis,
yep. Bad behavior at its worst. And a lot of it, most of it, I think even it just practically has to have killing all. And believe me, this one did have a kind of a indirect death that Betty Davis in her role caused. So I saw the movie and said, well, gee, I'm going to take a look. And some of these movies are real classics. And so sure enough, Double Indemnity, I'm going to go over about three or four of them. Double Indemnity was another one. And of course, Barbara Streisand. This movie came out in 1944. It has to do with an insurance scam, in which Barbara Steinwick is able to convince an insurance salesman played by Fred McMurray to plan a death for her husband who had just signed an accident policy, included Double Indemnity. So they try to pull it off, and E.G. Robinson plays the insurance executive who is able, investigator, who is able to kind of piece together and pull it off. But so Barbara Stanwyck is the bad girl in this one, and she actually is probably the only movie she ever made where she played a blonde, and I that kind of turned me off a little bit but man, she had Fred wrapped around her finger, no doubt. And he ends up, dying at the end of the movie and confessing to E.G. Marshall that what he pulled off. So that was a good one. And the next one I'm going to count. It's a classic. Billy Wilder directed. I think it was up for a couple Academy Awards. I don't know if it won any. My next one is really considered one of the top male bad guys. White Heat is the name of the movie. It came out in 1949, starring Jimmy Cagney. Now, Cagney had a background of being a tough guy, and basically he grew up in a tough part of New York, Upper East Side.
Right.
And so he lived his part, and particularly in the 30s when he had just a prolific number of movies coming out, he seemed to play a tough guy. Now, the tough guy could translate into a tough guy who's a good guy. It could be a bad guy who is a tough guy who stays a bad guy throughout the whole movie, or it could be a bad guy who's a tough guy at the beginning who becomes a good guy. played a lot. When you do four or five of these movies a year, right, in the early 30s, he really created an image and was somewhat typecast. Yeah. Well, as we move into the 40s, Cagney is kind of, decided to take on roles, and before you know it, he wins the Academy Award for not for being a tough guy, but for being a song and dance man in Yankee Doodle Dandy.
That's it. I love that movie.
From there, so all of a sudden he's a hoofer and not a shooter. And so he kind of takes that and becomes much broader. So his like incredible comeback role at the age of 50 is White Heat, where he ends up playing a psychotic, mother fixated robber and a murderer. I mean, he is just ruthless.
Yeah.
And he ends up breaking out of jail and basically goes back with his mom, but he has a slick broad on his arm most of the time by the name of Virginia May, all blonde, who's pretty nice looking.
Bombshell.
She was good in her day. Bombshell plus. And so he ends up, through the movie, he demonstrates several things my favorite is that he apparently, somebody in his gang crossed him and he wanted to get rid of him, but didn't have the time to do it. So he stuck him in the trunk of the car. And the guy said to him, gee, it's a little stuffy in there. Can I get some air? And he says, not a problem. And shoots five bullets right into the back, the trunk.
Yeah, I knew he was going to do that, yeah.
That's ventilation at its best.
Exactly.
That's all I can say.
Yeah.
So he ends up plotting to rob a chemical plant, but there's a undercover agent comes into his gang and gets their confidence and basically blows their attempt to heist this chemical plant. And the end of the movie is with Jimmy Cagney on the top of a silo with chemicals in it, and he's standing there, and what he does is he basically comes up with this quote, made it to the top, Ma, and then the thing explodes. It made it to the top, Ma, for you. Mm. And so that's the scene, and it's considered one of the classic lines to end a movie. And so, you know, it was just his swan song when it comes to being a gangster bad guy. And I don't think there's ever been a movie where he's been rougher and tougher than White Heat.
Yeah, so that was good. It's famous. Yeah, absolutely.
So, just real briefly, another one that I like is The Bad Seed.
It came on
Wednesday morning, and this is bad. This is not bad guy. This is bad, not girl, but bad little girl.
Oh yeah,
this little girl.
The worst.
Yeah, she actually, Rhoda was her name in the play, in the movie. It was based on a play that she did both roles. In fact, the whole cast seems to have reprised their Broadway roles into the movie. So there's not a lot of big names in it. Patty McCormick, who was a pretty good child star, TV, several other movies.
Always a good girl, by the way, a very good girl.
Yeah, always a very good girl. So what happens is that her mother has a sense, you know, senses something's wrong, and particularly when one of her schoolmates, who wins the penmanship award, rather than Rhoda, who should have won the award, according to her, ends up drowning.
Yeah.
And then when they happen to notice that then they know it's kind of peculiar the way he drowned, because he has all these imprints on his head that are kind of funny looking, and the mother realizes the imprints are exactly the size of the iron taps that happen to be on Rhoda's shoes.
Right.
So she immediately senses that there's something wrong, and then has some questions about her own upbringing and whether she was adopted or not. Well, what it boils down to is we learned through several other scenes in the movie that the mother was adopted, and that her real mother was a serial killer.
Ooh.
So apparently we have a situation where heredity is, you know, skipped a generation and moved on to Rhoda, and so she, you know, ends up killing her. There's a janitor that she ends up killing, and what happens is her mother realizes that she's got to do something to bring an end to it. So what she does is she ends up feeding a bunch of sleeping pills to trying to OD her. So she ODs, and then she decides that what she's going to do is she gets so upset about killing her own offspring, she ends up shooting herself. Well, the shot creates brings forth the police. They, you know, somebody hears it, calls the police. By the time they get there, the mother's dead, but they're able to pump Rhoda's stomach, so she lives.
Mm.
So
wow.
Here we got, but here's what's funny about it. In the Broadway play, they can run with that and have the little girl live. But the Broadway, but the production code, who, you know, censors movies, wouldn't allow that ending. So what they did is, in the ending, after Rhoda lives, they have a scene where she is, because her mother threw out the penmanship award, because what happened is that Rhoda basically took the penmanship award away from that little boy and kept it. Then the mother threw it away and threw it into a pond or a lake, you know, just a little bit out. So Rhoda goes out trying to get it, and they end the movie with her getting struck by lightning and getting killed.
Wow.
All to make it, you know, so that you can't have a movie where justice has to prevail in the end, and that's the way they did it.
Wow. Well, I like the play ending better, and
that was funny. So
she was evil. Man, she was evil.
Oh, you know, we saw that movie when we were kids.
Yeah.
You know, because here we are, we're, you know, in our, you know, maybe by the time it came on TV, we're probably in our early teens or. Mm-hmm. And that has a lasting impression when you watch it, because she has kind of an adult feel to, you know, the way she conducts herself. She's never in trouble, you know, other than obviously this very gross act she pulls. Mm-hmm. And you know, room's always neat, very clean.
What a smile! And what a smile!
Oh, and a cute smile, and she would. She was sort of like Eddie Haskell in a movie. She's very artificial and
Leave It to Beaver, Eddie Haskell.
Always saying the right thing. I just happened to watch it. Leave It to Beaver. They're on from 7 to 8, so I was watching it this morning. Eddie made his presence felt, and he reminds me of of the way that it was just such an artificial pleasantry that she had to her dialogue. We talked a little bit about Gaslight, and George Charles Boyer was right there. I don't want to say any more about the movie, but just to let you know that there's a couple other good ones.
Yeah,
Man Who Shot Liberty Valance with Lee Marvin. I guess, and we're finishing up. Oh, I got one other I'm just going to comment on real quick is Strangers on a Train. The Murder Flip movie where basically they're on the train, and it's Alfred Hitchcock in the early 50s, where Bruno Anthony, played by Robert Walker, who is another guy who always played pleasant roles. He was Private Hargrove during the war. Here he ends up playing a guy who wants to kill his father. And Farley, he realizes on the plane that Farley Granger, who plays Guy, I don't know his last name, but who's a tennis player, is trying to get a divorce and would really like to see his present very mean wife out of the picture. So Bruno concocts this idea of maybe them flipping victims, and they're murdering each other, taking each other. They got then alibis, etc. So this is something that's proposed on the train. Well, when it's left, Guy, the tennis player, considers it to be a big joke and kind of laughs off as, you know, he explains exactly what they're doing. As far as Bruno's concerned, he's got a done deal. So Bruno ends up killing the wife, but then Farley Granger doesn't come through and kill the father. So Bruno's just a ruthless guy. So that's the only other one I'd really like to talk about. The author that, by the way, the book it's based on is a Pat Highsmith, who had a crazy life herself, but she did a series of books on the talented Mr. Ripley?
Oh, yeah.
That movie?
Great one.
Well, she was the one responsible for those books, and she's probably the good piece. But I'll just comment, another one that came up is The Third Man, which we've both seen and enjoyed, Joseph Cotten and Orson Welles playing the bad guy, and that kind of hits the high points, and that's going to continue on. I would say that, there's The Third Man's on today this afternoon, and after that's The Stranger with Orson Welles playing a bad Nazi who's escaped and lives in the U.S. So, a little more to go. They move on, and then kind of gets a little lame as far as I'm concerned when they start trying to make Frankenstein and Wolfman bad guys.
That's bad.
Those
are terrible.
It kind of finishes up on Saturday on kind of a low note, but that's a day when kids can watch, so I guess they figure let's go for it.
Well, the kids should see those movies, of course. Yeah. Important. Very important for your upbringing as an American. You have to see those things.
Yeah.
Anyways.
So that's my report on the movie scene right now in terms of what's going on, and it's, the good old days. There's a lot there.
Remarkable. A couple comments. What's remarkable is how many of these movies have been remade.
Yeah, I mean, you think the Throw Cape Mama Fear. Under the Train, Cape Fear is a direct repeat, and then it's kind of sad. You think that we could, but it's all, recognition, people looking at the ability to make money, and you're taking a bigger chance when you do an original movie, perhaps, I don't know, remakes and sequels. The sequel thing is just a byproduct of that same, thing. It's just a kind of a remake sooner with a little twist to it. And sometimes there's not much difference between a remake and a sequel.
True. I never thought of it that way, but you're right. You're absolutely right. And one other thing I was going to mention, it's interesting. In my opinion, the best parody of these types of movies was Johnny Dangerously.
Yeah, I didn't look that one up.
And I'll just say a couple things about that. It's got some white heat stuff in it. And there's a mother involved who, I think it's one of the Stapleton sisters. It was Maureen. She was incredibly funny. She had all these diseases and had to see the doctor all the time. And every time Johnny would visit her, she had some other malady that was just so off the wall you wouldn't believe it. But she never stopped ironing the shirts of all the people in the neighborhood for money to survive. And he was going to get her out of poverty and all this stuff. And was outrageous. I mean, they just did it to the max. The makeup was amazing, especially on the men. They did a great job. If you haven't seen the movie, see the movie. It's a good hoot.
Yeah.
They've got one of the funnier parts of it is they've got two bits that are extremely funny. One is there's a younger Griffin Dunn, I think, was his little brother who was going to go bad. Johnny Dangerously's little brother. So he was about to get involved with a woman that Johnny Dangerously and his mom would not approve of. So he showed him this cartoon to educate him on the dangers of all this stuff. I won't say much about it. I don't want to spoil it, but it's hilarious. Yeah. And then the other, a couple other parts of it too is Johnny Dangerously is in prison and he's about to be electrocuted. They're going to break him out. So they have a faux priest in there who's got like the pieces of a machine gun on his person. And inside the Bible he's carrying as he reads passages from the Bible on the way to the electric chair. And there's a fake priest and he doesn't know any Latin. So he's saying all these things, dominoes and biscuits and stuff like that. It's just hilarious. And, oh, man, that's a keeper.
I'll just say one other thing, and that is that the scene with the priest going in with is a takeoff on two movies, Manhattan Melodrama with Clark Gable and Pat O'Brien playing the priest. Pat was, you know, typecast as a priest.
Of course.
And then there's a movie with Jimmy Cagney called Angel with Dirty Faces.
That's it.
Where he basically takes them down, and, you know, the Dead End Kids are in that movie, and they revere the Cagney, and Cagney at the end, we're not sure whether he fakes it or not, but starts crying and screaming, "Don't kill me," when he had told the kids, "I'll take it like a man, I can do it." So those are the two main situations where you see that in the Johnny Dangerously movie. Just takes off on it.
Yeah. They have a character in there too, some guy from some Eastern European country. Something, I can't remember his name, and he was hilarious. And his main feature was he swore profusely, but interestingly enough, he swore in such a way, his accent was so thick, you couldn't understand it. And I guess he didn't understand it when he heard it, so he repeated all his swearing incorrectly. So he would talk about farting ice holes.
Oh,
stuff like that, you know. So it's, again, you know, it's a, I think it's a classic. It doesn't get much play, but anyways, on to the fake news, which
is legend. So much. I mean, right now with on CNN they don't have breaking news because there's just too many things breaking.
Well, they call it breaking news, but it's lost. It's already.
Well, usually you see breaking news if you see breaking news, it's probably not breaking news because they're desperate and they have to put that. But now what we have, as I turn on CNN this morning, there are so many different stories. They do it. They just keep flipping them.
Yeah.
But they don't call it breaking news because there's too many things breaking.
Wow. Well, of course, you know, the Saturday Night Live skit where they interrupt the show for breaking news. Buckwheat just shot. Remember that?
Oh, boy.
That's a good one.
No, I watched
another
a little
parody.
Bit of it.
Another parody. Anyway,
yeah.
Sometimes I wonder if we're not living in some sort of parody.
Well, we got a fake news menu, which it's hard to pick which item to digest.
It's
covering here right now.
It's crazy. So let's sort through it and try and separate a little of the wheat from the chaff. And, of course, we're not political analysts. And I must say, that said, we probably know as much as anybody. No one seems to know what the hell is going on.
It's kind of hard. I mean, there's a level of frustration when you first, I find one level of my frustration is there are so many players involved on both sides. When the people that are investigating, you've got the Senate Intelligence Committee, you've got the House Intelligence Committee, you've got the FBI, you've got the Department of Justice, and and there's probably a lot of other investigative agencies that are smart enough to remain covert, and we're not hearing about, which is probably what they all should be, if possible. Obviously, you can't when you're dealing with the House and the Senate. So you've got these various players, and man, it doesn't. You know, when you got that many doing it, somebody's going to screw up, and that's part of it.
Now there's a lot of people involved in this thing, and when we started the call, I was listening to Greta Van Susteren interview John McCain on MSNBC, and yeah, I'm just looking at the, I put it on pause, I'm looking at the screen here, and it says, McCain, long ago given up on trying to understand statements of the president. Talk about frustration.
Yeah.
She was asking him a question about what something that President Trump said, and so he issued that statement, and then he said, I don't listen to what he says anymore, I watch what he does. And that's that kind of says it in volumes, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that we, yeah, the reaction to what he does, it doesn't make much sense to, I can tweet. I normally don't. I'm more of a consumer of tweets than I am a producer. So, but I have no desire to go and get up early in the morning when president seems to do these things. He seems to have his mad moments as soon as he gets out of the bed, and who knows how early that is. You're right. Look at the reaction.
Follow the ball.
Follow the ball. Follow, you know, and the ball can be a variety of things.
Yeah, exactly. Don't watch the fakes and the jukes and all that stuff.
Right.
And there's a lot of it going on, and I think this whole Obama tapped my phones thing. Aside from being the wrong terminology, is just totally distraction. That's all that was. That was just misdirection.
As they try to get through the, you know, what's happening in terms of his relationship or any of the with Russia and how it might have affected the election, and it seems like the closer they get in terms of trying to connect dots from these various groups that are doing the investigating, the more then we find that commotion is created to try to subterfuge what the real problems are, the real investigations are.
Yeah, and I have friends, you know, who are on the Trump side of the line, and they feel like it's the other guys who are creating all of the obstruction and distraction. And I'm going, well, like the distractor in chief is the president. I mean, he kind of leads the march on these things. And the thing is that I think the news media have to start going, not reacting to every head fake. And the biggest one is this Obama thing. And every time, you know, the heat gets turned up, Trump brings it up again. Have you noticed that?
Well, yeah, he one of his ploys is to create a new definition of wiretapping. Before you know it, he's creating a broader. He's doing his own kind of stumbling backwards as he tries to defend himself. And
because what happens is now everybody gets caught up in that.
Right, and so you find out, and that's, I think, I mentioned to you earlier before we got on, that Trump is exceeded in what he's trying to do, because he continues to be able to make the discussion him and rather than where the real problems lie. And so if that's been his goal, he's doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, his job rating should be very high, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
Not.
Well... Yeah, and I don't know, you know, how they conduct those ratings, but obviously it continues to plummet to an all-time low every time they, you know, break that out.
Yep.
I don't think that's necessary. I don't know.
What does it mean? Nothing, really.
Probably in his mind right now, he just seems to be headstrong on making sure that any political... in other words, he doesn't want to fall into the trap of being a politician.
Right.
He doesn't want to be the person who's promised something and doesn't deliver. So he is hell-bent on whatever he said he was going to, he promised, he's going to do everything he can to make sure he delivers that. And if along the way some of this, you know, kind of peripheral noise takes place, he doesn't really care.
Right. Well, the big things that are going on right now that will really change things for us, ordinary people, for a long time to come, are two things that I can think of. One is the healthcare situation, and the other is the Supreme Court. And, of course, the third, I guess I should mention, is Korea, nuclear war. That's somewhat important, I would think.
Then I read something where the current Secretary of State says, I really didn't want this job.
Tillerson,
Yeah, Tillerson making some comment. I don't know when he made that comment. Maybe he made that very early, but news kind of latching onto some of that. But yeah, I think that the health thing is, you know, the vote's going to happen today. Mm-hmm. Oh, God, I mean, it's like when they go back and forth, is it a question of giving more people the opportunity to get health care, or is it giving people options and a chance of getting quality care? I mean, the capitalism system of supply and demand with Obamacare has got, you know, its problems, as, you know, these insurance companies start bailing and all of a sudden we're left with a pool of you know, not young people anymore, and then young people don't want to get into these high, you know, end pools. So, I mean, we can't deny that there's needs for things to be done, that doesn't mean you throw out all the, you know, the
baby with the bathwater.
The bathwater, right, exactly. So, you know, but I just have one other comment about what does Trump read, and should we be surprised at what he reads? My feeling is that I went back because I happen to remember, I remember somewhere where Trump said he doesn't want to read the daily intelligence briefing.
Correct.
He says, I don't want that.
That's
now,
right.
He made that, you know, he made that comment back in December as a president-elect.
I know.
Now, I don't know where it's gone. But, you know, right then and there, we have a guy who basically doesn't care what the CIA, FBI, and all the other intelligence units, when they pull together a briefing for him, and he says, well, look, I don't want to read the same old stuff every day. So therefore, I don't need to read that. No thanks, but no thanks. If it's something real important, let me know.
Oh, wow. And plus, he's got deniability now, you know, that's the other thing he gets, you know, and he's just like us. I know what you know. I watch TV. You know, he's Chauncey Gardner. He's Chauncey Gardner from Being There, actually. You know, nobody reads.
Oh God, yeah. You know, he's getting there. He's not there yet, but he's getting there.
Yeah. yeah.
But you know, the thing about it is that, and this also plays into his image of not being political, not being a politician.
That's right. That's right.
Because you're exactly right. You mean I'm one of you. I'm getting my news like you do, and you know, and I'm learning and I'm reacting and doing
peeps.
This and doing that and
just one of the guys
tweeting away.
Well, So now the investigation thing, which is why I was watching John McCain. John McCain is calling for either a select committee in the Senate or, you know, a special prosecutor kind of situation. He would prefer the select committee, of course, because that keeps it in the Senate. But he's pretty much said, of course, reluctantly, according to him, which I think is somewhat sincere. I like John McCain, basically. He's saying, look, these guys, it's become too partisan and too divided and too uncooperative in the House. And I wouldn't, and you know, he couldn't have said that 3 days ago, but he could have said it as of yesterday when the Republican chair of the committee, you know, and everybody knows what happens, he went over to the White House before he briefed anybody on the committee about some intercept that he had, and he was complaining about the masking and unmasking of nationals, our people, in these intercepts, which are intercepts are, you know, people, our intelligence people eavesdropping on, you know, foreign diplomats / spies.
Yeah. He
goes over to the White House, briefs him.
With incidental, then, incidental.
Yeah,
you know,
incidental, yes. That's the word. So now he does a press conference all by himself. Up until now, he's been doing press conferences with the co-chair, the Democratic guy, the ranking. So now this, and you know, it was, I don't know about you, but I'm looking for cooperation. I'm looking for bipartisanship, you know, or nonpartisanship, even better yet. And I thought I was seeing it, but evidently, so the wheels came off the wagon and now that one's gone. And I'll tell you an interesting thing about all this is, as you know, I meditate, and I have this app I use to meditate that times my meditations. And when you hit done, it pulls up this picture of all the people who are meditating at the same time with you. And it shows their faces and little circles and how far they are into their meditation, all kinds of neat stuff. But at the top, they have a number of how many people meditated worldwide at the same time you did. My number is usually, on the weekdays, it may be close to 4,000 people. But ever since, I'm trying to remember when this started. I think it started 5 days ago or so, maybe six. That number has been over 5,000 every day. That's a big jump. I think people are more anxious. That's what I'm thinking this is about. I sure am. I do not appreciate the way our government is behaving and all this craziness, because it, God help us, if something really bad happens. What if Korea gets a nuke? And that's a worst case scenario, and that's a ways off. But there are other things that could happen. In the meantime, Russia turns off all the power in the East Coast, or, some other stuff.
The thing about Russia and the politics, a couple things I know is, number one, it seems like the TM movement might be related to anxiety, which, world troubles and all that. And I know that TM has had its ups and downs in terms of its popularity.
Yeah, well, this isn't TM. This is meditation, period.
Period? It includes TM?
It includes anybody who does any kind of meditation.
Okay, So it just seems to me that, it's kind of a, maybe
mm-hmm.
It'll end up to be a help in that way. The other thing, I kind of lost the thought on that.
Yeah, well, anyway, the theory there is that you're espousing, which is it's what I grew up with, so, I'm biased. But, the idea is, the people I really gravitated toward in college and like that were people who said, you can make a difference. I did it in high school, too. John Kennedy had a good effect on me. You can make a difference. Bob Kennedy was the same way. You can make a difference. Every person counts. And so, when meditation came along and they said world peace, one person at a time, I said, okay. Does that mean everybody has to meditate? No, what that meant was the more peaceful people they are, that are balanced and happy and all that good stuff, better decisions they make, it's contagious,
right,
et cetera. So,
there's actually, even if you don't meditate, if you're around people that do meditate, there is an effect.
Yeah, exactly. So, and the opposite. I was kind of noting the opposite, that as an anxiety index, the more people that you see, and during the weekend, that number almost gets cut in half, but the weekend numbers are high now, too. So, there's something going on. More people are closing their eyes.
Well, the other thing is, when I look back on things, you kind of wonder, should I really be surprised about this whole thing with Russia and controlling elections when basically they've successfully done it in Europe?
Oh, yeah.
What makes us so high and mighty that we can't be affected either?
Well, I think we have to start dealing with it that way rather than, there's this American exceptionalism thing that's been bred into all of us.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And it's
not helpful right now. It's not helpful.
Yeah, we're here and you're down there somewhere,
Yeah, I think it's much more helpful to, lock arms with other people who are having this problem. This is not the time to cut ourselves off from everybody and do all that stuff. There's downsides to globalism, I realize, but at the same time, there's strength in numbers. How can you deny that,
Yeah.
You look for the Russian people, if nothing else. Because if the rest of the world starts getting their act together, we've seen that once already when the Soviet Union fell, the more people that band together and get their heads on straight, the tougher it gets for leaders in Russia to maintain their power. Because sooner or later, those guys are in Russia are going to stand up for themselves.
Yeah, and the thing I remember when Russia crumbles is that there is a painful transition period.
Oh, terrible one.
That exists with those. It's awful. I mean, they become borderline third world countries with what they have to go through in order to make that transition to free capitalism.
Not just
market.
Even whatever form they're going to follow. Yeah, exactly. And
they got to make some decisions, but in the interim, they've got to live with the economic times, and they're not going to be they can't rely upon the government to help the state to do it for them.
That's a tough transition. I mean, that's a hard one. And we saw Arab Spring, same thing, These countries are used to strong leaders. And, Trump says this, and there's a certain amount of truth to it, that leaving some of these terrible people in charge
works to our best interest. It's not in the best interest of the people. But then what do you say when it gets worse? You know, freedom creates something that was worse than they had before because there's a vacuum and some more evil guy or gal or whatever moves in. And
it does. You run the risk when you make that transition of, you know, I think Cuba might be an example of that where, you know, our efforts to try to make them capitalize, all of a sudden we get with Batista, and before you know it, man, he drops the ball, and who rushes in? Baseball crazy Castro.
Yes, and Che Guevara.
So there's many examples of that where, you know, we've tried to make it work and it doesn't.
You can't foresee these things. They have to be organic. They have to come from inside. Yeah, I agree. But then what's the answer to all that? I think, you know, part of it's already going on. Communication, good news, not positive news, but real news. Education. I think that's really the bottom line. Don't you? Education.
Well, yeah. I mean, we see education is so important, and you know, it becomes the foundation upon which so many things need to be built. I mean, the crime here in Chicago is just a classic, you know,
example
for me. Oh, murder rates high because people don't have jobs. People don't have jobs. They end up resorting to other things. And before you need, well, these people need to be educated so we can get them good jobs.
Yeah. And it's not easy. You know, it's not 1950 anymore, or even 1970.
No,
the name of what you do in the name of a job is real different. Contracting economy, freelancers. You know that.
Well, just the nature of what you do because of technology.
Yes.
You got so many variables that you're trying to overcome as you, and it's in some ways it's scary. As our technology gets greater, that means that the lifespan of your knowledge is going to be so small that you're going to constantly have to be reeducating yourself in the future in order to become employable.
Yes, and you may not get employed. That's another thing. Is that the contracting is the new way you get.
That's what I ended up doing. I mean, I became a I kind of learned my niche with accounting, and I think accounting is what I learned in accounting is that you cannot be a general accountant. You have to have a specialty, and that's what I learned. I learned a specialty, and I learned a specialty within a specialty. I learned nonprofits, and within nonprofits, I learned associations. Jeez, you know. How fine does it have to get?
Yeah, exactly. The slice gets thinner and thinner.
And
like you say, technology. People, in keeping up on technology is not an easy thing. I'm a software developer, and you know, I get overwhelmed.
Your situation is extremely tough because, to me, I'm seeing technology on two sides. I'm seeing it with the way you handle the information technology, and then you also have to understand the knowledge of the transactions themselves and being able to record them properly. So you've got two variables involved there. You know, you got to learn a new type of software, and even if you're using the same old software, you know, they're economically induced to constantly change it so that you have to buy a new version of it and you learn something new.
Yes. A prime example.
It's a whole other... We've taken a side journey here that obviously...
Yeah,
what can I say?
It's what's creating this problem worldwide, I think, a lot of it. It is. It's not Muslims or other immigrant groups, you know, that's nonsense. It's the nature of a job. It's the nature of our existence to an extent. So all this other stuff is really just a distraction for that. And I do think that capitalism is very viable, but what made it survive this long is that it adapts. So I think we're headed toward a new era of capitalism. Something's got to change in here somewhere, because what's going on right now is not working.
No.
Anyway, that said, good talk.
Yeah, I think we covered a lot of territory there in politics, economy, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. Like I said, good talk. Very enjoyable. I will catch you on the flip side.
Sounds good. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.